Welcome to Croxley Green Baptist Church Sermon Podcast.
Jonah, an example to us of prayer. A week or so ago, I was in Cornwall with Barbara. We had the opportunity to explore the place. She, being daring and fit and healthy, walked the West Coast path in that area. I, being terrified of cliffs, didn't. I am the ring bearer, and I chose to go through the mines. Those of you who have seen Lord of the Rings or read the book will remember the reference. And I visited the industrial archaeology of the area. So I saw Pendeen and the Levant mine and Geeva. And I heard of the story of the miners who were tunneling, working away at one of the tin layers. There were about 10 of them and a couple of apprentices and two people who'd come in as well to examine what was going on there, checking up on how things were going. And suddenly, as they were underground, there came a rustling and a fall of a few bits and pieces from the ceiling. And the experienced people looked at one another, only one look, and ran. They knew what it meant. Not all of them did. Not all of them made it out. But those who could read the sign moved fast, escaped from the tunnel before the roof fell in, and survived. They call that first fall, that initial crumbling of a few rocks, a godsend. I think we can understand why. Jonah was the victim, or rather a survivor, of a godsend. And we heard this morning in our reading, in fact, the last verse of chapter 1, as well as the reading from verse 2. And it's worth remembering that the Lord provided the fish. It was all part of the plan. But this was unknown, of course, to Jonah. Jonah. Who's Jonah? What do we know of him? He's the son, we read in chapter 1 and verse 1 of Jonah's book, the son of Amittai. But we know a little more. He was a prophet of God, probably from the reign of King Jeroboam II, who reigned in the early 8th century BC for 40 years and was one of the kings of Israel. If you read 2nd Book of Kings and chapter 14 and verse 25 and following, you'll find that Jonah is mentioned there. He comes from a place called Gath Hepher, a town only a few miles from Nazareth. More perhaps on that later. And he is speaking to Jeroboam. He's advising him about what to do. Jeroboam II, according to Encyclopedia Britannica, had a kingdom that extended from the borders of Hamath in Syria now, on the Orontes River, down to the Dead Sea, and he recaptured some other territory. We read in Amos chapter 6 and verse 13 of towns that are now under his control, Canaim and Lo-Debar, captured in about 760. In King Jeroboam's reign, there was great material success and prosperity, greater than Israel had known since the days of Solomon. Though at the same time, Amos was also prophesying, and we know from him that the social conditions were very far from being what God would approve. But Jonah is there, speaking to the king, advising him to stabilize the territory. So Jonah is not being picked on out of the blue. He has experience as a prophet, that is, one who speaks on behalf of the Lord, addressing the ruler of Israel. And there are some themes within that very background before we even start on chapter 2 for our own age. The dangers of outer prosperity even gaining of power, but ignoring social and personal inequalities and problems. Ill fares the land to hastening woes a prey, where wealth accumulates and men decay, as the poet once put it. So we have Jonah, an experienced prophet who's done work at the highest level within Israel. But now, he's been told to address the capital of the most powerful empire of the time, Assyria. And this seems for him to have been another matter. Jonah flees. He heads west. He has indeed fled. And Kenneth Bailey suggests, along with others of his culture and background, Jonah had made a fundamental mistake. Jonah seemed to expect that the power of God was the power of God within God's territory. This is typical of Near Eastern and Middle Eastern cultures. The God of the territory was limited to that territory. If you went to Babylon, you would pay your respects to Marduk. He was part of the Babylonian Empire. And that was his. You moved to Hattusas, capital of the Hittites, and you would turn your attention to Ishtar. If you went to Philistia, you would come under the jurisdiction of Dagon. And now in Nineveh, it is a version of him, Dagon, who was worshipped. Interestingly, Dagon is represented as a fish god. It would appear that poor Jonah, in his desire to escape from one fish, has been captured by another. Don't anybody tell you that God doesn't have a sense of humor. But it's a false impression that Jonah has. And it challenges us again. How limited is our picture of the scope and range of our God? Especially when he seems to feel distant. Jonah's made that mistake. Do we? Let's look at Jonah's prayer. In verse 2, he speaks of his distress, calling to the Lord, and the Lord answers. For deep in the realms of the dead, the depths of Sheol, as the older translations put it, Sheol is the ultimate afterlife of wraith-like limbo, life without meaning. Strict translation, often the belly of Sheol. It's a term, according to the commentators, that refers to death's door from a variety of causes. That's where Jonah feels that he is. He is desperate. You hurled me into the depths, into the very heart of the seas, and the currents swirled about me. This is a metaphor, but it's also literal for Jonah. It's a metaphor for devastating life events in the poetry and the descriptions of the Old Testament, and indeed some of the New. The sea was the source of evil, of catastrophe. Flash floods wash away everything. Rivers in that part of the world were known to do this. And the legend of Atlantis, probably carrying the folk memory of the eruption of Thera and the tsunami which followed 1,000 years earlier, can be related to this. But it's quite probable that this is more literal than metaphor for Jonah. But remember, Jonah has been swept away from death's door to his current position. The Lord provided the fish. We're encouraged to put perspectives on things that sometimes we call suffering. It doesn't mean to make light of it, We're not in the Jeff Lucas territory of I've just been kicked in the head by a sheep, praise the Lord. We're not into that sort of area. But remember that when Jonah speaks verses 2-4 in our reading, he is saying that he's already been saved from death by being in the great fish. The fish itself is not the problem. The fish is the process towards the solution. Parker Palmer, as John Ortberg tells in his book, If You Want to Walk on Water, You've Got to Get Out of the Boat, describes a situation where he was exactly in that position. He's been taken on an exercise where he's got to abseil. At this point, I would probably stop reading, never mind actually going on the exercise. In the middle of the week, he says, I faced the challenge I feared most, 110 feet above solid ground. The instructor tied a very thin rope to my waist, a rope that looked ill-kempt and seemed to be starting to unravel, and told me to start abseiling down that cliff. Do what? Just go, the instructor said in typical outward bound fashion. So I went and immediately slammed into a ledge 4 feet down from the edge of the cliff. Bone jarring, brain jarring force. The instructor looked down at me. I don't think you quite got it. Right, I said, being in no position to disagree. So what am I supposed to do now? The only way to do this is to lean back as far as you can. You have to get your body at right angles to the cliff, so that your weight will be on your feet. It's counterintuitive, but it's the only way it works. I knew that he was wrong, of course. I knew that the trick was to hug the mountain, to stay as close to the rock as I could. So I tried again, and slammed into the next ledge about 4 feet down. You still don't have it. Okay, tell me again what I'm supposed to do. Lean way back and take the next step. Ooh. The next step was a very big one. But I took it, and wonder of wonders, it worked. I leaned back into empty space, my eyes fixed on heaven in prayer, made tiny moves with my feet and started descending down the rock face, gaining confidence. I was about halfway down when the second instructor called up from below. Parker, I think you'd better stop and see what's just below your feet. I lowered my eyes very slowly and saw I was approaching a deep hole in the face of the rock. To get down, I would have to go round that hole, which meant I could not maintain the straight line of descent I'd started to get comfortable with. I would need to change course and swing around that hole. I knew for certain that attempting to do so would lead directly to my death. So I froze, paralyzed with fear. The second instructor let me hang there for a while, for what seemed like a very long time. And finally she shouted up, Parker, is anything wrong? I don't want to talk about it. Then, said the second instructor, it's time you learned the motto of Outward Bound. Oh, great, I'm about to die and she's going to give me a motto. And then she shouted 10 words. If you can't get out of it, get into it. And Palmer goes on, this is your life. These are your failures. No helicopter is going to come while you're away. No genie will pop out of the bottle. No magic eraser will make things happen. You can't get out of it. So get into it. Take a step toward trusting God in a difficult area. I think that's probably where Jonah was. The fish is going to turn out to be part of the solution, not the problem. And he's beginning to realize this. He goes on in verse 4. And he says, I've been banished for your sight, yet I will look again towards your holy temple. That sense of remoteness from God. Do you remember the words in Psalm 22 and verse 1? My God, why have you forsaken me? Words that Jesus uses later on the cross. Remember the gulf between Dives and Lazarus. A gulf unbridgeable for Lazarus, for Dives, as he looks towards him. But again in verse 4, God's nearness is to be found, correcting the misunderstanding of Jonah. Remember Jacob? Running in fear, guilty at how he's deceived his family and his brother, fearing the worst. A refugee, he lays down to sleep, and he dreams a dream and sees a ladder and figures moving up and down towards heaven. And when he wakes, says, surely the Lord is in this place, and I was not aware of it. Can you begin to see a pattern emerging within this prayer? A pattern of antithesis in verse 2, in verses 3 and 4, and again in verses 5 and 6. Each have the misfortune that Jonah has perceived, balanced with a positive response. Being heard in verse 2, I called to the Lord and he answered me. In verses 3 and 4, I've been banished from your sight, yet I will look again towards your holy temple. In verses 5 and 6, the engulfing waters threatened me, the earth beneath me barred me, but you, O Lord, brought my life up from the pit. The drowning, the tying up within the seaweed in verse 5, again, it's metaphor, but it's also literal from Jonah's experience when he thought he was to be drowned. In verse 6, that sense of being smothered, buried under a mountain, the underworld of the ancient world, deep below. Tartarus in Greek mythology, the place of evil. And remember David, once fast track rising within the kingdom of Saul, and then driven out, unable to link with his best buddy Jonathan. Almost at the mercy of the king, he flees. He flees to his enemies in Philistia, and even the Philistines won't accept him. They think he's mad. He finds himself in the depths of the earth, in the cave of Adullam, with a few renegades. And even them, they reject him when they hear that their homes have been devastated. Deep in the ground, David recalls that God is with him, and he takes confidence and strength to start again. That too is reflected in Jonah's experience. Notice, by the way, in verse 7, as in verse 4, there's a reference to the temple. This, the commentators believe, is symbolic for the presence of God, the place where God is. Jonah is realizing that God transcends the boundaries that he'd previously thought of and understood. The temple, notice, is holy both times. It is made holy, the place, because God is there. Remember Moses. Take off your shoes from off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. Not because there's something special about the ground, but because the presence of God is there. And this reinforces the everywhereness of God seen in earlier verses. Cast your mind back to Elijah. After his triumph on the mountain against the prophets of Baal, he's driven away. He takes refuge yet again in a cave. And God comes to him and he says, what are you doing here, Elijah? Actually, he doesn't quite, does he? He says, "What are you doing here, Elijah? Why are you stuck here? This isn't the purpose I made you for. I made you for something else, to speak for me, not in here, but out there." And so in verses 8 and 9, Jonah finds final reassurance. Those who cling to worthless idols turn away from God's love. "But I, with shouts of praise, will sacrifice to you. What I vowed, I will make good. I will say, salvation comes from the Lord." It links all these ideas that we've gone through. Giving himself up once more to God, honoring God for what he is, where he is, and that he is. Matthew chapter 12 and verses 38 and following show the Pharisees meeting with Jesus and demanding a sign from him. In the background of it is that thinking. He's from the north. Nothing good comes out of the north. Remember Nathanael? Can any good come out of Nazareth? The Pharisees are thinking the same. Since when do we get a prophet out of the north? They seem to have forgotten Jonah's origins. Jesus, in that passage, reminds them of the story of Jonah and how in 3 days he was restored, and something greater than Jonah is coming to you now. The response reminds them of their generation's failings and the improbability of their responding to such a sign. And of course, we know from the book of Jonah, restored like this, Jonah did go to Nineveh, and Nineveh turned and repented. So what are our responses in times of trouble? Has God become our last resort, or are we conscious of his ever presence, as Jonah became in this situation? Do our own troubles prevent us from putting them into perspective, or to blind us to where we may have already come, as Jonah initially mistook the fish as being part of his doom and not part of his rescue? Reread Psalm 139, one of the greatest psalms sometime. "O Lord, thou hast searched me and known me." And it goes on to remind you that wherever you may go in the world, if I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths of Sheol, you are there. If I try to flee to the west or dwell to the uttermost parts of the sea, even there, your presence is there. Your right hand protects me. God's presence is everywhere. He can seem distant, but through this prayer, Jonah found him again, just as we can find him again. Jeff Lucas is the anathema of laptops. And one of the situations he fears most, and perhaps some of you can share this, is when you've got to get on, you're in a hurry, you open your laptop, you switch on the button, and it says, "Microsoft is updating. Do not turn off your computer. Installing 1 of 36. And you think to yourself, "How can he do this to me at this time? I've got to communicate." Is that how God seems sometimes? I can't get through. There's a blockage. Jonah's prayer is for you in that situation. He's not gone away. His presence makes the place holy. This place is holy not because it has a cross in the window, not because we turn up here on a Sunday, but because God is present here. Each one of us is holy. is blessed because God is present with us. That too is what Jonah had to learn, and what in his prayer he came to realize and understand at a greater depth than he had before. His prayer is for us too, in the midst of our troubles, to put us into our proper perspective, so that we too can say, what I have vowed, I will make good. I will say, salvation comes from the Lord. Let us give him thanks that our salvation does come from him. Amen.